able to treat what should be the what we aimed for during these 4 days, which is define the perturbation theory for non-abelian gauge theories and discuss a bit of its renormalization at one loop. So what we did yesterday and the day before was to discuss in detail how you should proceed to gauge fix in a consistent way the gauge theory in order to be able to perform perturbation theory and calculation, both in classical theory and in the quantum theory. So we started from an SU2 gauge theory. SU2 was for simplicity. So we have a gauge potential A, which is in fact a collection of A, mu, A, A, 1, 2, 3, because that's a three generator of the Lie algebra of SU3. And I'm going to introduce again, since I'm going to discuss interaction with matter, I'm going to introduce an SU2 charge Dirac field. So I'm going to have a Dirac field psi, which means psi alpha I, where I goes from 1 to 2, and alpha goes to 1 from 1 to 4. This is the Dirac indices. This is the group indices in the fundamental representation. And the A's are the group indices in the adjoint representation. Okay? And we ended up by the following rules that if we quantize the gauge theory in the Feynman gauge, which is one particular convenient choice of gauge, we have to add, so you have psi and psi bar, of course. This has the usual Dirac field. We have to add the ghosts fields, which are a way to represent the gauge fixing condition. So we have some C and some C bar field, where C means a C A. A equal 1, 2, 3, and C bar is a conjugate Grassmann field. A equal 1, 2, 3, Grassmann, but spin 0. And in the same representation that the gauge field, because that condition on gauge fixing each component of the gauge field. And with this Feynman gauge, the final action is a sum of two terms. So first, we have the usual Young-Mills action, which is minus 1 over 2d squared integral d for x f mu nu a f mu nu a. That's the standard Young-Mills action. We have a gauge fixing term, which represents the contribution of the Feynman gauge, which is, with my notation, minus 1 over 2 xi. Xi is just a parameter. Okay. D for x. D mu a d nu a so it changes the weight of d mu a mu so that it's not exactly zero, but it fluctuates around zero. It cannot be free. So Feynman gauge means that fixing that d mu a is equal to some epsilon A, and if you want to make an average over epsilon A. And we have the action for the ghosts, which involves the Gauss field and a coupling to A mu that we can write. Where is this action for the gauge field? I'm trying not to get the factor for x. It's integral d4x c bar A delta AB minus the Laplace operator CB plus epsilon ABC d mu c bar A mu B CC. Okay. And in fact, in terms of Feynman gauge, is something which is something like C bar A D mu covariant derivative with respect to mu, which involves A of C. So it has this form, in fact, in a covariant way, because it corresponds to. Okay, and finally, we had the standard action for the Dirac field involving the coupling with the Gauss, which we coupling with the electromagnetic field, which is integral d4x psi bar I d slash minus m psi, where this means, as usual, the standard coupling to the electromagnetic field, namely in terms of components, d4x psi bar alpha I gamma mu alpha beta delta IG d mu minus A mu A well, there is a delta alpha beta, sorry. No, there is a delta. No, that's okay. I'm sorry. There is delta EG d mu minus I A mu A of X minus M delta IG psi G beta. And if I am not mistaken, oh, there is a delta alpha beta here again. Well, that's the same term that in electromagnetism, so there is a delta alpha beta. And we need just an index mu, which is, of course, a sigma A over 2 IG, where sigma A is a Pauli matrix. It's the generator of the gauge field. Generator, well, the elements of the algebra. Okay. So this is the same thing than for the QED, except that you have a Pauli matrix for each component of the field. Okay, and so the Feynman rules. So, and now with this, basically the path integral that we have to perform is integrate over the gauge field, integrate over the ghost field, and integrate of the Dirac field with this usual exponential factor I S Young bis of A plus S gauge fixing of A plus S ghost of A C and C bar plus S for matter, if you want, of psi, psi bar, and A. Okay. And if we want to compute, so this is basically the partition function of the theory, and if we want to compute now vacuum expectation value of time order product of products of operators, we have to perform this path integral with exponential of I times the action times the operators, the corresponding quantity for the operators, and normalize this by the usual rule. Okay. And so now, of course, what does it give for rules of perturbation theory? Okay. So perform perturbation theory means performing an expansion in the coupling constant. And you can check that it's equivalent to perform a perturbative expansion into H bar if you had but 1 over H bar as it should. In fact, it's a perturbative expansion in G squared, because if you count well, as we are going to see, a diagram with one loop diagram which corresponds to a diagram with G squared. Okay, so what are the rules of perturbation theory? I started to write them yesterday, but let us write them again in more detail, and I hope without any sign mistake. So first, you have the gauge propagator, gauge field, propagator. Okay, but I'm going to write like this, which corresponds to the inverse of the term which is linear in A. And the term linear in A involves in F mu nu just the ordinary term of quantum electrodynamics, the same one, plus the gauge fixing term. And so the gauge fixing term, let me write it simply G mu nu A B of K in Fourier transform. So this corresponds to computing in perturbation theory A mu A of X A nu B of Y at order 0 and taking the Fourier transform. It's a Fourier transform of this. And well, one important point is that in order to perform gauge theories, you have to rescale A mu A into G A mu A, so that the linear term in F mu nu, remember F mu nu contains dA minus dA plus I, some commutator of A. So if you make this rescaling in G, you have here a factor g, here a factor g squared. So you see that the commutator is one order further. And S Young Mills expressed in terms of this is order one for the linearized term. So that's a linearized terms in the action are of order one. But it's just a change in the normalization. So with this notation, so you see a propagator, in fact, is associated. It's a correlation function in the free theory, non-interacting theory of those gate fields. So it carries indices A mu and B nu. So a propagator carries a momentum K. And in fact, this is a calculation that you have probably done in QED, because at that point, the rules are exactly the same of QED, except that the gauge, if you want, color index that is carried by the gauge field is conserved. So you have just a delta AB. That's just a new thing. And you get the propagator, which is the propagator of the photon in the Feynman gauge, which is minus I over K squared minus I epsilon plus. I am in the Minkowski space. And then you get H mu nu plus chi minus 1 K nu over K squared. And I'm using the notation that K mu is minus the energy squared, if you want, plus the momentum, momentum squared, because I'm using the minus plus metric. Okay? Yes?
When you say linearize, you mean in G?
Pardon?
When you say linearize, does it mean in the coupling?
It means that I make this transformation and I keep only the term of order 1 in G. So it means that I only keep in the action the terms that involves 2A. All the nonlinear coupling terms are disregarded. Simply because they are small if G is small in the functional integral. Yes?
More like you're expanding in G squared, right? So order one.
Pardon?
You're expanding in G squared, right?
Yes.
So order one in G squared is, you know, order two.
No, you are going to see that you do this just redefinition of the field. It's just a redefinition of the field. And once you have done that, you are going to see that there are no G term, but only G squared, G4 term powers. But that's something very easy to see. That's a redefinition of the field of the AMU. So you see. So if you use this redefinition of the field, of course, gauge transformation will depend on G because they are nonlinear in A. It involves the. But that's the redefinition of field that is natural in perturbation theory. But it's just a redefinition of the field, so we don't change the physics. Pardon? Pardon?
T is a constant instead of H.
What is a constant?
G.
Yeah, yeah, it's a coupling constant, as we are going to see. G is a coupling constant. So it's both the charge of the gauge bosons and of the fermions. So it plays the same role as E. So it's similar to E in QED. But it's also the coupling. Because E measures the strength of the coupling between the electromagnetic field and the charged particle in quantum electrodynamics. And here, G measures the strength of the interaction between both the Dirac field, the Dirac particles, and the gauge field, but also of the interaction between the gauge bosons themselves that now interacts. Okay? So both it's both the charge, and but it's also the coupling constant of the theory. It's exactly like in QED. Okay, so this is the propagator. And you see that the propagator written like this is now inverted. So it has been inverted, so there are no zero modes. But you see that, as you expect, if k squared equals zero, so if you are on mass shell, k mu g mu nu is equal to zero, so it's conserved. So now, I wrote already what is the propagator for the ghosts. So the propagator for the ghost is something like that. This denotes CA of X, C bar B of Y, because the ghosts carry charges. Yes? Pardon?
How do you get that H mu nu?
Oh, H mu nu is just the, it's just a space-time metric. So H mu nu is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? This is a Minkowski metric. This ensures that this is covariant under Lorentz transformation.
Is there a reason why we choose psi equal to 1 in QED and we don't do that here?
You can choose psi equal 1, but you can choose any psi. So I think in QED, the simplest gauge is to consider psi equal 1, indeed, yes. Psi at that level. Changing a different psi corresponds to choosing a different gauge fixing procedure. And the final results should be independent of the procedure. Gauge fixing. Okay? Okay, so the ghosts, the propagator of the ghosts, I'm going to denote like this, is correspond to this correlation function of the C and the C bar in the free theory. So it's an analog of the Dirac propagator, psi, psi bar, psi bar. But now for the ghost, and if this carries a momentum k in Fourier transform, this is, there is again a delta AB, and there is a minus I over k squared minus I epsilon plus. So it's the same propagator than for the bosonic scalar field, the scalar field. With the delta AB. Okay. But these are fermions. So if you invert, this is minus. C bar C is minus C C bar. Okay. And of course, for the Dirac field, we have the standard. Dirac propagator. Which is except for the numbers here, the same diagrams, the same that you have seen in QED. So this is delta IG times the Dirac propagator that you have seen in QED. Okay. So now you have the interaction vertices. Okay. And the interaction comes from three terms. First, you have the standard interaction between a Dirac particle and the gauge field. That, okay, I'm not going to write here. But then you have interaction between three gauge field. That comes from the fact that F mu nu squared may contain the DAAA. That comes from the DA times A terms in the Young-Mills action. And remember, this was of order 1 over G squared. But by this rescaling, this is a term of order g cubed. So you see that this term is of order g. So it's indeed an interaction term proportional to the charge of the particles. And if you want to write it in a symmetric way, so each gauge bosons carry a Lorentz index related to its polarization mu and a charge index A. So let me write this B nu and C rho. Okay, so A, B, C goes from 1 to 3 are gauge indices, and mu rho equal 1 to 4 are Lorentz indices. Okay, and each of these incoming particles carry some momentum Q, so K P and Q are four momenta. The four momenta carried by the gauge bosons. Of course, you have a delta function conservation of the momenta. So you have K plus P plus Q has to be equal to zero, conservation of the momenta. And then if you work out a little bit what's going on, you see that you have an epsilon ABC. This is the structure constant of the Lie algebra for SU2. If the group is not SU2, you have to replace it by the general structure constant of the corresponding group. And then you have a term that is a bit complicated. It's H mu nu K minus P rho plus the terms obtained by permutation. So I've wrote it in a symmetric way. So you see that you have an interaction term that depends on the, you have the metric of space-time you have the momenta, and you have a combination of the momenta. So you see that the interaction depends on the momenta. That's simply because there is an interaction, there is a coupling between the polarization of one of the gauge particle and the momenta. So you see, for example, it's here. Kk minus p is basically the momentum that goes through this, and rho is the polarization of this particle, this index. So it means that there is an interaction between the polarization momentum coupling. Okay. Okay, so this is a three-vertex interaction. Now you have a four-vertex, a four-gauge field interaction, like this, that comes from the fact that you have an A terms coming from the products of the commutator. So this term is of order G4 divided by G squared, so it's a term of order G squared. And if you work out the same thing, so I have a gauge boson that carry charge A and Lorentz index mu. Here I have B, nu, C, rho, and D, sigma. And they carry momenta. Let's say P, Q, well, K, P, Q, and R, let us say. The momenta doesn't play a role, but so again, you have A, B, C, D goes from 1 to 3. Mu, nu, rho, sigma goes from 1 to 4. And P, Q, K, P, Q, and R are four momenta. So these interaction terms, in fact, doesn't depend on the momenta. There is a minus I term. And then you have something a bit more complicated. You have epsilon A, B, E, epsilon E, D, I'm sorry, C, D, E, times H, mu, rho, H, nu, sigma, minus H, mu, sigma, H, nu, rho. These terms come from the fact that you have commutators, so that's that. And then you have plus epsilon A C E epsilon B D E times epsilon mu epsilon rho sigma minus H, I'm sorry, mu sigma H nu rho. And the third possible term is epsilon A D E epsilon B, C, E, well, I write them just for completeness, H, mu, nu, H, rho, sigma, minus H, mu, rho, H, nu, sigma. Okay, so these are the three terms. So that's a general expression with a structure constant. But for SU2, it's a bit more simple because epsilon ACE epsilon BDE is just a combination of delta function, delta AB, delta CD, minus delta D, AD, delta BC for SU2. So you can write this in different ways. Okay. And again, the expression here, I just wrote it so that it's completely symmetric if you interchange the legs. Okay? So these are the, if you want, the three gauge field, gauge bosons, interactions. And this is a four gauge boson. Interaction. And you just have to be a bit careful when you write them. Okay, and finally, there is an important term, which is the ghost gauge boson interaction vertex that I wrote, that comes from the fact that in the action for the ghost, there is a coupling between C, C bar, and A, which, again, comes from the fact that you have, so it's a vertex which is like that. Okay. It comes from the fact that you have C bar C, let's say C bar A C vertex. So it's over the G because C is over the one and A is over the C. So it's a vertex interaction proportional to G. So again, it's, and if the gauge boson carry, if the ghost carries some color indices A and B, if the incoming momentum for the ghost is K and the outcoming momentum is P, and the incoming momentum for the gauge boson is Q, and the gauge boson carries color charge index C and an index mu. Okay. You have, of course, K. Sorry, this is, and this is the incoming momentum P, the incoming momentum Q, and the incoming momentum Q. So this is then K plus P plus Q has to be equal to zero. And the contribution. Pardon? No, I mean P is the incoming momentum. I'm sorry. K, P, Q. Thank you. So this is K, this is P, this is Q. K plus P plus Q is equal to zero. And you get a minus one, if I'm not mistaken. And then you have a I, P mu. So it's the polarization of the incoming gauge boson interacts with the, is coupled to the this momentum. So it's minus the momentum of the outgoing ghost field and epsilon ABC, the structure constant. Okay, and that's it. And in addition to that, you have the usual Dirac interaction vertex, where you are going to have an I alpha G beta and mu A, and you are going to have a charge that is going to be proportional to G again, and you are going to have an interaction that involves some momenta P mu and no, there is no momenta. Yes. No, you are going to have the gamma mu alpha beta, the Dirac matrix, and you are going to have the matrix element IG of the polymatrix sigma A. So this is the interaction that comes from the psi bar A psi term. The Dirac gauge boson interaction. Okay. Yes. The ghost lives in the adjoint representation. Yes, that's what I stated. Here, again, the ghosts live, you know, are, you want a triplet in the adjoint representation, simply because there is one gauge, one ghost, anti-ghost field associated to each gauge fixing condition, and there is one gauge fixing condition per component of the vector potential. Yes?
The ghost interacting with the gauge field diagram seems to be not symmetric if you swap the two ghosts.
You cannot swap the two ghosts because here is a C and here is a C bar.
No, I see. Okay.
So I think it's okay.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the way it should be, but it was puzzling.
It will not be a problem. Perhaps I have not written it in a completely symmetric way. Perhaps it's more convenient to write this P mu into a P minus K over 2 or something like that. So it's not written. Here I have, indeed, this P means that, in fact, you have a coupling, if you want, the momenta carrying by the anti-ghost line, the line ghost. So it's indeed not symmetric if you change this into this. But in the amplitudes, when you compute, and the final results will come out to be symmetric. Yes?
The terms with the Minkowski metric, they look kind of similar in the last two lines of the
Does that make sense? You are right. And there is perhaps.
Yes.
No. You are right. I think there is a typo. And I think I have to check. I think I spotted this typo last year, and it's not just written on this note. Okay, so there is probably a typo here, yes. This is mu, rho, mu, nu, so this should be mu sigma, something like that. Okay, there is probably a warning typo. I'll check, and if you don't trust my check, look in the book by Peskin and Schroeder, which where everything is. Look, Peskin. Schroeder book. Yes. Now, I remember last year when someone told me, and it's possibly corrected on the online course and not on the printed version I had, which is just the printed version that I left last year. Yeah. Okay. Yes?
When you get the factor of there are, like, for the middle one, it was g4 over g squared. Like, where is the g squared coming from that you're dividing?
Where is
the factor of g squared that you're dividing?
This one? So this is proportional to g squared, yes?
But, like, right, g4 divided by
g. No, that's because if you count in the action, there is a 1 over g squared in the action, and there are 4g, 1 coming from each a. So the final result is g squared for this purpose.
Where does the 1 over g squared come from?
It's just because the Young-Mills action is 1 over g squared times the action expressed in terms of the original gauge field that transforms under gauge transformation in a way that doesn't depend on a. I'm sorry, that doesn't depend on G. So if you rescale this, gauge transformation on the gauge field starts to depend on G. So it's a bit. Yes?
What do you mean when you say that G is the charge of the gauge boson?
That what?
Over there, when you say G is equal to the charge of the gauge boson?
The charge?
Of the gauge boson?
Yes.
What does that mean? I mean,
it means that
when you measure the charge, for instance, associated to the current carried by the gauge boson, they are proportional to G. So it's proportional to G. The charge of the gauge boson is not necessarily
the electric
equal to the charge of the Dirac fermion, but they are proportional.
This isn't the electric charge, right? Because otherwise for Z this would be zero.
No, no, this is the gauge charge.
Okay.
The gauge, the charge associated to the symmetry, the SU2 symmetry.
Colored.
So there are three different kinds of charge. They mix under global SU2 transformation. But they are conserved as a rule. So these are the SU2 charge, no U1 charge.
Yeah.
The charge, when I'm talking about charges, I'm discussing the SU2 charges. Okay? Okay. So, these are the rule of perturbation theory. And out of this, well, once this theory has been constructed, you can discuss what are the irreducible or vertex functions that appears in the calculation of the physical amplitude. So I'm going to just to discuss very briefly how they look at one loop order. So what are the one loop diagrams of the theory? Okay, so first, let's see the two-point function for the gauge field. Okay. So this is first the propagator. And then you have to construct the diagram at one loop. And well, first, so this will be, so you have this, so first you have this kind of diagram. Because you have this vertex. Okay, and you see that there is a G factor here, a G factor here, so this is a term of order G squared. Okay, and this vertex being written in a symmetric way, if I don't write how you must contract all the indices, but this is, you discovered that there is, applying Vick's theorem, there is a symmetry factor which is 1/2, basically, because this diagram, you can interchange those two factors. Then you have another diagram that comes from the fact that since you have a 5-4, you have a 4-particle interaction, you may have the same tadpole diagram than in the 5-4 series that we discussed in the first week, which again has a factor 1/2 symmetry factor. And then you have to contract in all possible ways the indices, so it's a bit of a mess, but it can be written if you are careful. And this diagram is also over the G squared, because the vertex is emitted. So in fact, those two diagrams are over the G squared. Okay, but now you have also one possible diagram, which comes from the contribution of the ghost, because you may have an internal loop of ghost field. So the ghost field is a Fermi field, so it's C bar, so it is the line, the propagator has to be oriented, like for the Dirac particle. And so you cannot interchange those two factors. So the factor, symmetry factor is 1. Okay, that's exactly like for fermions. And then you must remember that when you apply the perturbative rules, since the C and the C bar are fermionic field, when you plug Vic, you must use the Vic theorem for fermions, which means that there is a minus sign that comes from the closed loop. Okay, that's just Vic theorem for fermions. Okay? And this sign turns out to be very important. And then, of course, you have a finite diagram if you have Dirac particle, which is the same kind of diagram, but with Dirac particles, with also a minus sign. So this diagram is a diagram of QED. It's the only diagram in QED you have for the propagator of the photon. And these are the new diagrams that comes out from the fact that the gauge field now is non-abelian. Okay. And of course, this diagram and these diagrams are also of order G squared. Okay. Basically, because each of the particles carries charge proportional to G. Both the gauge field, the ghosts, and the Dirac particles. Okay, so this is a reducible two-point function. And now you can play with the irreducible three vertex, which is the original vertex. And then, so this vertex is of order G, remember? And then, well, I'm just going to write them. You have this vertex plus this vertex, well, plus a bunch of vertex of similar diagrams obtained by just choosing which of the line is attached to the three vertex and each of the remaining two lines are attached to the four vertex. So we have, well, we can write them. We can write this is this. You see, here you have three vertex. Here you have one three vertex and one four vertex. And then you have this and this. Okay. And you see this vertex, this diagram of order G cube. Okay. And in addition, you have a vertex with a loops of ghosts. Again, with a minus sign. And a vertex with a loop of Dirac particles. Again, with a minus sign. Okay. Then you have a four vertex, which is original vertex, which is of order G squared. And then you have a list of diagram which contains this diagram plus a bunch of diagrams obtained by permuting the external legs. I'm not going to write them. You have this diagram. Okay, so here you have four three vertex, here you have one four vertex three, plus a lot of diagrams, plus this diagram. Okay, plus a bunch of diagram, and then minus the standard loops involving ghosts, minus the standard loops involving the Dirac fermions. Okay, all those diagrams are of order G4. Okay, and you have in fact, another possible diagram, that is a one-loop gluon diagram. Of course, you don't have such a term at a tree level, but you have the possibility to have a diagram like this. Plus minus a diagram like this. I'm sorry, with the ghosts, minus a diagram like this. And this is over the G. Okay? So these are the diagrams for the fermions. So now we have the ghost two-point function. This is the ghost. And the ghost two-point function is the ghost propagator plus G squared times these diagrams, which is the analog of the self-energy diagram for the electron in QED, except that now it's a ghost. Okay? And again, you have an interaction vertex for the ghosts, which is the standard interaction vertex, the standard interaction vertex over the G, plus this diagram, which is a diagram that you have in QED, but you have an additional diagram that you don't have in QED, which is allowed because the ghost field, the gauge field interacts. Okay. And that's it. And these diagrams have order G cube. Pardon? Because you have this diagram, which is new because there is an interaction. Pardon?
Above?
You could think, no, you can't have any other diagram at one loop. Okay? If you can imagine another one. Why do we?
I don't understand why you stop the sum with just that term. Shouldn't there be other diagrams as well?
Yeah. These are the only two diagrams at one loop. You can construct any other diagrams. I'm constructing the irreducible diagram at one loop. Okay. Okay, and this diagram is of order G cube. Okay, and then you have, well, the same for fermions. So I'm not going to write them, but basically if you have a fermions, a Dirac fermions, in gauge field, it will be the same. for this 2-point and 3-point fermions. Okay, and I'm going to stop there, not discussing the higher diagram, simply because these one are the diagrams that we need to consider for renormalization. Of course, have all the other diagrams. Okay. Okay, so I have still just half an hour, so let me just discuss the issue of renormalization. So, ultraviolet divergences and renormalization. So, as for QED, we expect that, and we know that gauge, non-abelian gauge series have short distance singularity. And this comes simply from the fact that the diagram for the ghosts and the diagram with the propagator for the gauge fields behave like 1 over k to the 4. The diagram for the fermions behave like 1 over k because it's k slash, but you have to remember that the vertex here carries some k. Yes? Pardon?
The propagator for the gauge field was 1 over k to the 4 and 1 over k squared.
It's 1 over k to the 4, but there is a k in front of it. Above.
Oh, okay.
So you are right. There might be direction where there is a 1 over k to the 4. But the direction where there might be a 1 over k to the 4 are precisely the unphysical polarization state. So I won't discuss that state. I'm sorry, what? I wrote k4. No. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Well, I'm tired. Sorry, this was a type. Of course, it's 1 over k squared. Sorry. Okay. And so now, if you just do some naive power counting, and let me just go back to consider again this diagram. Let me go back to this one. See, let's consider, well, first this diagram. This diagram, it's an ordinary vertex. It carries a lot of Lorentz and color indices, but it's basically 1 over k squared, and you integrate over k to the 4. So if you consider the fact that you have some momenta that are less than lambda and do some naive power counting, these diagrams diverge like lambda squared. Okay, so you have a dangerous lambda squared term. These diagrams also, because you may have, remember, there are some combination of momenta here. But if the two momenta carried here are here and here, then you are in a poor situation. So these diagrams may also diverge like lambda to the 4. This has lambda to the 4. But then these diagrams may have also some momenta here and some momenta here. So it gives a k squared. And then there is divergence that is d4k over 1 over k squared times 1 over k squared. So it may have a p squared log lambda. And in fact, if you work out a little bit the symmetry factor, this diagram is going to diverge like, remember, this two-point function carries, where is it written? It carries color indices and mu nu. So in fact, the divergence for this diagram will be a lambda squared . Well, there will be first a delta AB, and then there will be the lambda squared H mu nu with some coefficient, plus a log lambda P mu P nu, plus a log lambda P squared H mu nu. Let me do H mu nu downstream. So these are the dangerous. The divergence, and there are some coefficients here. Okay. And now these diagrams is also, remember, there is a P momentum here. The vertex of the Gauss contains a P, P mu, which is one of the momenta here. So there might be a P, a 1 over p square. So this may also, this contributes to this divergence. Okay. And it contributes also to this one and this one. So if you want it, let me write in red, because this term is very bad. So let me write in red this coefficient. So this corresponds, these diagrams contribute to this divergence, this diagram contributes to this divergence, this diagram contributes to this divergence, and it also contributes, let's say, to the red one here. This is red, this is red, this is red, where this coefficient is red, this coefficient is red, and this is just the ordinary loop of fermions in QED, which contributes to logs, but which doesn't contribute to this. Okay. So now let's go back to this diagram. Okay. So you see that these diagrams, you may still have a divergence that involves you may have some lambdas. So where is it written? If you count well.
Is the diagram all amputated?
Pardon?
Is the diagram all amputated? The legs are all amputated?
Sorry?
Let me draw the irreducible
yes.
diagram in the...
Yes.
We amputated the legs.
Oh, yes, they are amputated. So everywhere, I consider that these are amputated lines. This was implicit. Yes.
When you count the power, like you didn't take care of the contribution from the leg.
No, I took care. Because these diagrams may be proportional to p squared, because when I amputate the propagator that comes here, but I don't amputate the vertex. You say?
Only the vertex.
Only the propagator. So if you have a vertex like that there that carries a momentum p, I keep that momentum. It means that instead of having the propagator, I write one. That's it. Okay, so if you walk, you are going to see that, for instance, that these diagrams is going to contribute like a lambda. This going to contribute like a lambda. So in fact, these diagrams will contain some log lambda
terms.
Okay, this one. These diagrams, it turns out to be convergent. These diagrams may contain a log lambda, etc., with some coefficient. And these diagrams may contain some lambda, but the lambda will disappear by parity, I think. So they may contain, those diagrams contain also some log lambda terms with some complicated symmetry factors. Okay. But they, in fact, they may contain some lambda plus some p mu log lambda terms. So that you have terms that are dangerous and terms that are less dangerous. Okay. And if you continue the analysis, well, this diagram is very, very dangerous, and we don't like it at all, because it would induce that, it would mean that, you know, taking into account the quantum correction, in the action there should be a term linear in AMU, which is clearly not gauge invariant. So in QED, you can write this diagram, but it's very easy to see that it is equal to zero. Simply because you have an internal loop of fermions. You see? So you have to integrate over k, k over k squared plus m squared, where m is the mass of the fermion, so it's a k slash, etc. But by parity, and also if you consider that the fact that you have some gamma matrix, because you have a k mu gamma mu, and that since the trace of the gamma matrices is equal to zero, anyway, for many reasons, this is equal to zero. Okay? Well, these diagrams are also equal to zero in gauge theories, basically for the same reason. So, okay. Now there is this diagram. Well, and these diagrams. So you see, this diagram may contain, this is 1 over k squared, this is 1 over k squared, and there is a k. So these diagrams may contain a lambda plus a p log lambda, where p is the momentum carried by the... So it contains a log lambda term and a log lambda terms, okay, for this diagram. Okay. And finally, this diagram, again, may contribute by some lambda and some log lambda terms, because it's interaction of a gluon of a, so there is a p here. Oh no, there is no p here. I'm stating something. No, there may be a p here. Oh, so it's here that I'm. No, okay, no, I'm saying something quite different. Okay. So this diagram will contain a log lambda, and this diagram may contain a lambda plus a p log lambda. Okay, so that's dimensional analysis. So you see that you have, in this dimensional analysis, You have log lambdas divergence as for phi to the fourth theory or QED, and you have some dangerous lambda or lambda squared divergences. So why do you have log lambda? Well, for the same reason than in QED. We have those lambda because, in fact, the coupling constant, the dimension, is zero. Exactly for phi to 4. Because if you think about the original action, d4x f mu nu a f mu nu a, where f mu nu a is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu a minus or plus I epsilon a b c a mu b a nu c. You see that, well, the original action was this. You see that for this to be dimensionally consistent, A must have the same dimension than derivative with respect to the distance, namely the dimension of a length to the power minus one of a mass or momentum to the power one. And in this case, f mu nu as dimension of a length to the power minus 2. So this has dimension of a length to the power 4. So this has dimension 0. And therefore, g has dimension length to the power 0. Okay? As for phi to the 4. Yes?
How do you write these terms that correspond to the diagram, like log
maximum? I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you.
How do you write down the terms for the different diagrams, like log lambda or log lambda?
How do I write them?
Yeah.
Well, you have to compute them explicitly by writing the Feynman integral associated to this diagram. So you have an integral over some internal momentum, taking into account all the Lorentz and group indices, taking the trace, and then seeing that if you have a divergence, which is integral d4k, and you have some 1 over k squared, 1 over k squared, some momenta like this at large k, or the lambda, then this gives a log of lambda. It's the same kind of analysis that we did to phi to the 4. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to detail calculation of a single diagram. I just want to discuss the final result. But you are going to see that next week if you follow the course in QED by Dan and Tibra, where you are going to do this calculation in detail for QED and perhaps for gauge theory too. Perhaps. Okay. Anyway, the calculations are exactly of the same kind, except that it's more complicated because of all those vertices with carrying momenta and carrying group indices. But if you are careful, just sit. That's the same kind of analysis. Okay. So the point is that the phi 4 theory, so you see, like the phi 4 theory, the coupling constant is dimensionless, which means that Young-Mills theory in d equal 4 has a property of scale invariance, classically. It means that if you take a solution of the equation of, no, if you take any solution, if you take any gauge field configuration, A mu A of x, and you change it into A mu A of lambda x times lambda, with lambda some factor, global factor, The action stays the same. So let us write this A of lambda. The Young-Mills action of A lambda is equal to the Young-Mills action of A. If you make a scale transformation according to these dimensional rules to any gauge field configuration, you get another gauge field configuration with the same action. So in particular, if A is a solution of the equation of motion, A lambda will be a classical solution of the equation of motion. So it means that Young-Mills theory is scale invariant in four dimensions, exactly like phi to the four. It's an interacting theory, and a highly non-trivial theory, but it has this property of scale invariance. And in fact, it has even a larger property, which is the properties of conformal invariance that I'm not going to discuss. In fact, there is also conformal invariance. Okay, so now let me try to discuss in 5 minutes the solution of a problem that in fact puzzled the theoretical physicists for 10 years, basically, which was, are gauge theories renormalizable? Yes?
The whole action is scale invariant, right? Not just the S. Yang-Mills
term. Pardon?
Is the whole action?
The full action, well, the Young-Mills action is gauge invariant, and the Gauss action is also scale invariant if you define what is the scaling dimension of the Gauss, and if you write the Gauss action, which is, where is it written? It's written here. You see that the Gauss have also dimension one. Yes, the Gauss field has dimension of a length minus one. And as far as the gauge fixing condition of Feynman is considered, it's also gauge scale invariant. So everything is, so the original action is scale invariant, and we managed to have a gauge fixed action which is scale invariant. Yes. Okay, so now I have 5 minutes to summarize something that took 10 years for theoretical physicists to understand, which is whether gauge theories are really renormalizable, because for a long time there were technical difficulties. People didn't have the correct gauge fixing procedure, and then after that there were still difficulties. It's a very hard problem. But you see, the main problem is that first you need two things. You need to have no lambda squared and lambda divergences. And second, you need to have relations between the log lambda divergences. Because you see, you have some log lambda divergences. For instance, let's see, just consider the two-point function here. You see, if the coefficient of the p mu nu log lambda term is not the opposite of the log lambda p squared h mu nu term, then the one loop propagator will not be scale invariant. You see, because you need that to obtain first respect gauge invariance. For instance, you want that if you have the two-point function for the gauge field, which carries some momentum p, you want that p mu times this object that depends on mu nu, you want this to be equal to zero. Otherwise, This means that unphysical polarization states propagates. As in QED. Okay. And this will be required basically if there is a relation between the two coefficients of the logs. You see. Also, you need that the coefficient, so if you have a log terms that contains a dA, dA term, log lambda. Then you have a log lambda terms in the action that is proportional to the DAAA and the log lambda terms that is proportional to the AAA term. You see. So if the coefficient of proportional to log lambda of the 4, 3, and 2 point function are not related in a precise way. So if you have a coefficient A1, A2, and A3 are not related in a very, well, in a fixed way, then it means that if you introduce counter terms, you can introduce counter terms. But they are not gauge invariant. So you start from an action which is gauge invariant, and if there is no precise relation between the coefficients of the log, you think, okay, I can renormalize the theory, but the resulting theory is not gauge invariant. So, in fact, the correct procedure to renormalize the theory in a gauge invariant way is non-trivial, and it was proven that it was possible. So first, it was proven that it was possible just at one loop by an explicit calculation by Gerhard Toft around 72. It was an explicit calculation. He used a trick called dimensional regularization. Then there was a proof that this is possible to do that at all orders by Lee and Zijustin, I think around 73 or 4. This is not Ben, this is not T.D. Lee, but another Lee. And then there is a beautiful algebraic formalism to study this renormalization of gauge invariant theory in a very, very different way, which is called the BRST formalism that I have no time to explain, but you will meet it in CFT and string theory. So I just want to mention the name. Okay, so it turns out that thanks to gauge invariant of the bare theory, of the original theory, you can renormalize the theory. So you have a lot of divergence. First, the lambda and the lambda squared divergence disappear. So you have no lambda squared and lambda divergences. So you have no need to introduce terms like a mu, a nu that would break gauge invariance. And second, the log lambda divergences are consistent with gauge invariance. So this is just, I just explain you what is the problem and why, well, oh. There is a solution, period. And finally, let me just end up Well, we started just with 5 minutes late, so I just have time to, of course, state the most important result, that the fact that gauge in theory are invariant, which is the result of Toft in 72, and then which was rediscovered and used for building a theory of strong interaction by Gross, Politzer, and Wilczek around 73 or 74, which is a discovery that since the theory is renormalizable, so the theory is renormalizable, and it has just one coupling constant. Which is basically alpha of Young-Mills, which is G squared. So it's renormalizable, there are logs. So it means that first, as for 5^4, you may define a running coupling constant and the beta function. So you can define a beta function for alpha Young-Mills. Exactly in the same way we defined it for 5^4. And of course, the crucial result is that for Young-Mills theory, this is, if I am not mistaken, alpha Young-Mills squared. Remember, in fact, the coupling constant is G squared, so it's alpha Young-Mills squared. And there is a factor which is, well, there is a 1/4 pi squared, as usual. With my notation, there might be a factor 2. But the important point is that there is a minus 11 divided by 3 times a constant that depends on the group, which is just defined by the fact that F A C D F B C D is equal to C2 of G delta A B. So this is called the Casimir representation of the group. And for SU N, this is equal to N. Plus a contribution of the fermions, but I'm not going to write the fermions. So you see that for SU2, you get a factor 2, as you get a factor minus. So it means that the beta function as a function of alpha Young-Mills is negative. This is for Young-Mills. Instead of being positive, for the coupling constant of 5^4, or for the alpha coupling constant of QED. The sign is different, and that was a wonderful discovery of this physicist, which means that Young-Mills theory are asymptotically free in the ultraviolet regime. Remember, for 5^4 of QED, the coupling constant becomes small, the running coupling constant, the effective coupling becomes small at low energy and strong at high energy, which makes the theory problematic. For gauge theory, it's the opposite. The running coupling constant, the effective coupling constant of the forcing of the energy goes to zero as 1/log of the energy when the energy E becomes very large, which means that the theory is weakly coupled at high energy, which is very nice because first it explained experiments that were have been done at that model. It explains why inside a hadron, the quarks may be considered as free particles interacting weakly, a gas of free quarks. So it was a justification of what's called the parton model. Inside the hadrons, the quarks and the gluons interact weakly because they have at very high energy because the hadrons are very small. So this is a justification of the hadron. And also it says that at low energy, the theory is strongly coupled, which is just an explanation. It's not just a justification of the fact that the gauge theories leads to a very complicated, strongly interacting physics, interacting theory at low energies, which is not a problem compared to the problem. So a theory which is strongly interacting at high energy is problematic because you assume that the theory was weakly interacting at high energy in order to define the renormalizable theory. So if the theory is strongly interacting at high energy, it's a problem with the formalism. For an asymptotic free theory, it's not a problem. It just states that the theory is very different at high energy than it is what you expected at low energy. It is very different than what the theory you started from at high energy. So the theory is consistent at high energy, and it's non-trivial, but consistent at low energy. Okay, and in particular, the celebrated phenomenon of confinement, the fact that, in fact, you cannot observe gauge bosons because they are confined, or you cannot observe the Dirac fermions or the chiral fermions because they are confined, is just, well, a reflection, a non-trivial reflection of the fact that the theory is strongly interacting. So you need to new tools. Perturbation theory is not enough to understand the physics of gauge theories at low energy. Okay, and I think I should stop there, and you'll see the details of the calculation and the details of the physics of gauge theories in courses next week and after next year. So, thank you.